floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It is walking the floor time with me, Chris Shiflett. I'm sitting in my hotel room in Florida, Pensacola, Florida, and I'm looking out my window at white sand beaches and sloppy little wind swell waves and guys and girls surfing and sunning and having a good time. And it is beautiful. I'm just recovering from our big night last night at the Hangout Festival, Gulf Shores, Alabama. Played a crazy Foo Fighters set, had some good friends come up and jam with us, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, and a couple of the boys from Zach Brown's band got up and played some tunes with us too, and it was really fun. And right now I'm just sitting here drinking coffee, trying to wake up. Listen to this. That's my morning coffee, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm trying to get my head out of the sand and get my podcast done. And I'm sorry I'm a little late with this episode, but it's been a very busy several weeks leading up to it. We've had some food gigs, lots of my kids' baseball games, and what else? Rehearsals for our upcoming tour. Pretty much going to be gone all summer into the fall. And probably 8 million other things that I can't remember right now because I'm tired. And let's not forget, you know, many of you folks know that I'm a huge boxing fan. And a couple weeks ago, we had that disastrous dud of the Mayweather Jr. Manny Pacquiao fight that finally happened. And as everybody knows by now, it completely sucked. It was super boring. And it occurred to me as I was watching it, I think boxing in general and Floyd Mayweather Jr. specifically are perfect microcosms for how our modern capitalist system works. You have a couple of guys making all the money, right? Just a handful of people making all the money, and the consumer has to pay more and more and get less and less and less. The whole thing was frustrating. I heard a lot of people. I was at a big party watching it. There's probably over 100 people there. And people were angry. People were upset. It brought out the populist in just about everybody. People that didn't even know they were populist liberals turned into populist liberals just over 12 rounds. It was great. But it only took about a week for boxing to right the ship and deliver us Saul Canelo Alvarez versus James Kirkland down in Texas. That was an all-action-packed 3 rounds of violence and skill and beautiful heart and determination on display. And I don't know if anybody watched that. It was free on HBO. You didn't have to pay $100 for it. And it was more action in about 30 seconds than in the entire Mayweather-Pacquiao fight. So hooray for Canelo Alvarez. He's going to save boxing. That's right. Well, boxing doesn't need to be saved. But if anybody was going to save it, it was going to be him. What else is going on in the world? Lots going on in the world. We had Deflategate happen since the last podcast we did a few weeks ago. But who cares about that? That's nonsense. We had riots in Baltimore, which to me is just kind of indicative of America's ongoing inability to think about root causes. Just think about it. Just think about root causes. Think about the things that lead young men to burn their neighborhoods down. That's all I'm saying. I'm not going to get too deep into that one. Root causes, America. Come on. That's my rant. Let's get to the interview today. I have a great interview that I did a while ago when I was in Chicago with Foos. It was actually the day that the first episode of Sonic Highways premiered on HBO. We were in Chicago for it, and I got to go by Bloodshot Records and interview Rob and Nan, who own Bloodshot Records. And if you don't know Bloodshot Records, they are a legendary indie insurgent country label out of Chicago. And they put out a lot of records. They've been around for like 20 years. in the interest of full disclosure, the Dead Peasants are actually one of the artists on their 20-year anniversary record, which is out now. It wasn't out at the time of the interview, but it is out now. But they've also put out loads of great records by artists such as Ryan Adams, Robbie Foulkes, Alejandro Escovedo, Old 97s, you name it. They're a huge, hugely influential record label in the alt-country world and beyond. So let's get to my conversation here with Robin Nan from Bloodshot Records. Walking the floor. Mama, I'm hurt. So, you guys recently put together your 20th anniversary compilation record. I'm curious how that was for you. Was it like looking through an old family scrapbook? Did you get kind of emotional during that process?
Well, part of it was we're always uncomfortable looking backwards, so we never really did.
Right.
That and it's not like we're sitting on a vault full of unrecorded material. We tend to, when we have something, eagerly and excitedly put it out. And the market right now is not really conducive to a lot of reissues.
Right.
And we just wanted to do something that would look forward. And when it was primarily the youngins in the office who came up with this idea and reached out to all these bands, It became immediately apparent just how exciting the whole thing would be, because there's these people who are now citing records we've put out as influences.
Sure.
Which is just unbelievably flattering.
Like, how's the feedback been from the bands, from the, your artists that were covered on the record?
They're delighted.
So there wasn't anybody that was like, get that fucking version sucks, get that off.
Not yet, or they're keeping that to themselves. Or...
Right.
Yeah, so far everyone's been loving it and excited to hear that these other bands wanted to cover their songs.
And a lot of them are, a lot of the picks were really surprising, like the punk band Diarrhea Planet from Nashville, who have a lot of buzz around them, and I had honestly never heard of them before this, and they love the Waco Brothers, and they picked a really slow, quiet, obscure song from one of their first records, which I wouldn't have thought of in a million years. And they completely tore it apart and rebuilt it as this fast punk thing. And when the Waco Brothers heard it, they were just floored. They loved it. They loved it. And that's what we all love about what we do here, is people are taking these things and then filtering them through their own experiences and turning them into something completely new.
It seems like there's always been this connection between punk rock and whatever you want to call it, alt country, Americana, roots music.
There has been from our perspective, but I don't know that the world sees that.
I'm wondering, in the early days of this scene, and you guys have been around now for 20 years, so you were kind of there at the beginning, or pretty early on in it. It seemed like a lot of those bands came out of punk rock or out of rock and roll. Like, maybe they weren't guys or girls that listened to country or mainstream country growing up. But now this genre has been around for so long that it seems like it's reflecting back on country music now, where it's not as outside of the mainstream. Do you guys have a sense of that?
Yeah. When we first started, there was a very black and white sense of what is and what is not country, what is and what is not punk, and never the twain shall meet. And over the years, a critical language and acceptance has grown up that it's okay for these two things to kind of mix and mutate and draw off of each other. Whereas when we started, country radio stations, magazines, clubs would have absolutely nothing to do with us. And same with punk
clubs.
Did you
make an outreach to those folks? Like, did you try
to get
records?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we were ever trying to fit in with a country crowd, but
right.
The Get Smart big iron doors would just shut really quickly.
What do you think the connection is between the sort of the mindset of punk rock and the mindset of Honky Tonk and Hank Williams and some of those older artists? Because there's always been a strain of punk rock people that kind of gravitate to that as they grow up and mature, that maybe they start out with the Dead Kennedys or whatever, but eventually they sort of see the kindred spirit in you know, Hank Williams or whatever.
Well, I think, you know, at some point you get too old and tired to turn over police cars and set them on fire and smash the state. You know, you just got to deal with the everyday shit of life. And
is that what you guys were doing at the time of founding this label? I don't want to get you in trouble here.
I went to enough Black Flag shows to see enough, you know, things that there's no way I'd want to be doing now. But there's a populism and a connection with the audience and a simplicity, a total lack of artifice that, you know, you can draw a straight line from Bob Wills to Johnny Cash to the MC5 to Black Flag and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
And I think also the lyrics being dark and about real everyday issues and concerns and not prettying them up. I think that works for both, you know, classic country and punk rock.
And while the subject matter is dark, it's real, but it's also, at the end of the day, most of it can be extremely hopeful. And the way the presentation, it was, you know, classic honky-tonk and all that stuff was hard times filtered through, like, we got to have fun on this Saturday night because then, you know, Sunday we got to go to church and then Monday we got to go back to that really crappy job. And your song reminds me a lot of kind of the Ernest Tubb presentation of things, where it was like, you know, the subject matter of that song is pretty tough, but the way you bring this buoyancy and brightness to it, that Ernest Tubb would be singing about terrible, terrible heartbreak, but with a big smile, and everyone would be dancing. Right. And at the same, you know, when we first started, there was a pretty specific funneling of people who had been, you know, raised and cut their teeth in the punk scene, who were tired of everything that they saw near and dear in the underground being co-opted into the mainstream. And then all of a sudden there's, you know, Cocaine Blues by Johnny Cash. That, you know, that's pretty punk rock. And from there, it just grows.
Well, what were you guys doing when you started this label? Were you, or are you musicians? Were you in bands at the time?
We were not musicians. We were drummers.
Both of you? In the same band?
No, in very different bands. And we both also were college radio DJs and worked in different parts of the far background of music, business-related stuff. I mean, mostly just to work with bands we liked. And and so when we met, I was DJing a country night at a punk rock bar.
Here in Chicago?
In Chicago, yeah.
Are you guys Chicago natives?
I am born and raised, and I left for long enough till I wanted to come back. I went to college in Olympia, Washington, and that, I think the scene there had a big influence on my musical tastes. And then, you know, once I was back here and DJing in bars, punk clubs, I'd throw in some country music, and some people would be very offended and other people would be delighted. And so it was those people who were delighted that were making requests that got me doing a full country night at these punk rock bars. And then Rob and I met because he was making a lot of requests. And, you know, at that time, Chicago was seen as, you know, it could be the next big thing, the next Seattle. And, you know, with the Smashing Pumpkins and Liz Phair and Urge Overkill, the majors were, you know, signing up bands right and left that sounded like those bands. And it certainly felt like, you know, punk rock had been, as Rob said, you know, had been co-opted. And so I think personally we were looking for something new that spoke to us, that was still, you know, personal and underground and not commercialized. And there was this, there were these bands playing in the same, you know, underground rock bars, but that all had a thread of some kind of American roots forms running through their music. At that time, most of it was country or bluegrass and some, you know, acoustic blues. But, you know, so when we decided to name that, I mean, our first compilation was just Chicago area bands that had that sort of theme in their music. And so,
who were the bands? Like, who were the bands that were around the Chicago, you know, all country scene?
It had the first recordings of Robbie Foulkes, the Handsome Family, Freakwater, the Bottle Rockets,
Waco Brothers,
early incarnation of John Langford.
Yeah.
And then, as a nod to country, Chicago's country music past, we were able to dig up a couple of 45s from the 1950s of the Sundowners, who were this 40-year-long kind of Sons of the Pioneers band that played at all the honky tonks in Chicago.
So there was a honky tonk scene back here back in the day.
Yeah, and in fact, it was from getting into the current scene that we discovered the rich history of Chicago country music. And so in the 40s and 50s, there was a very vibrant scene in town. There were a number of bars along Lake Street that where bands would come and do residencies, you know, a week or two long, country bands. And the Chicago Barn Dance, is that right?
The National Barn
National
Dance.
National Barn Dance.
Chicago was Nashville before Nashville was Nashville. Hmm. It was the company town.
I like to think L.A. was Nashville before Nashville was Nashville. I feel like everywhere was Nashville. It's like there's this, you know, the sort of myth that Nashville is the home of country music. And obviously nowadays, it has been for a long time, the home of the mainstream country music business.
Right, yeah, now it's the company town. Yeah.
Right, the more I've sort of explored it as I've, you know, over the years as I've gotten into it, you know, I grew up in California. I had no idea that every city in California in the 40s and 50s and through the 60s had these huge country music scenes, you know, that were a lot of local bands and all the big bands of the era toured through there. And
yeah, knowing there's Spade Cooley and Hank Penny.
Yeah, and of course the whole Bakersfield thing that happened a little bit later. But so it sounds like that was the same case here. It seems like it was the same case everywhere.
And, you know, back then with travel being harder, I think it was more common for bands to do, you know, week-long residencies in a bar. And it wasn't so much of just a show, but people went out to dance and for the whole experience.
That's one of the odd things about how the music business has changed over the years, that if you look back at the way, you know, Buck Owens and Johnny Cash and people like that toured, they weren't, at least way back in the day, they weren't traveling around playing in like the local arena. You know, they were playing in these little clubs like the Palomino when they were huge artists that had, you know, number one records on the radio. And it was just such a different...
Johnny Cash played at the Palomino?
I don't know if he... I'm sure he did at some point over the years. But the Palomino was like this...
Yeah,
like
I played at the Palomino.
Right. Well, we're probably about the same age. When I first started going to the Palomino, it was to see like heavy metal bands and punk rock bands and stuff like that. And I used to look at all the old pictures on the wall like, who the fuck are all those guys? You know? I had no concept of what that place meant. But that was like a really important venue in California country because it was like on the way from point A to point B. So right. All the big bands would wind up playing there.
Yeah, a nice money gig in between the big cities.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I got off topic there.
No worries.
So in the beginning, I wonder if you could talk about like the or just continue to talk about the sort of the music scene that you guys were a part of here and what led you to want to start, like why did you guys want to start a label? Had your bands been signed to major labels and had a bad experience or a good experience, or what led you to go, you know, we're gonna document this this scene that's happening around us?
It was just a boredom and naivete, and we didn't really know what we were getting ourselves into, but we thought that this, we'd go to all these little clubs and all these different little clubs, and there'd be these one or two or three really interesting bands that didn't necessarily know about each other. And in the meantime, what you're reading about in the media, in these things that they had back then that made out of paper, newspapers and magazines.
I've heard of those things. Yeah. I remember that and, from my youth.
And zines.
As she was saying, every band that had a guitar and a wah-wah pedal was getting snapped up after their second show. And it just seemed so boring. And then you're reading stories about, you know, Flipper getting signed to major labels, or, you know, and it's just like, what? My world makes no sense anymore. Flipper was mine, you know, right, they were the shittiest band on the planet, but they were my shittiest band on the planet.
Did Flipper get a record deal at that point?
Yeah, they were on, I can't remember which major, but they got signed to a major based on Kurt Cobain wearing a Flipper t-shirt.
I mean, I remember, yeah, that was like 7 Seconds got a major label record deal, and Circle Jerks got a major, like, they just signed everybody.
Yes. So it was really boring and confusing and offensive, and then so we saw this kind of underground of the underground that while all these A&R guys on expense accounts were pillaging through the town, they were completely ignoring all this stuff. And to me, it was super interesting what they were doing, and we just thought, okay, let's, you know, pony up a couple of $1,000 each and put out this record and kind of give a name and a central location and a kind of a sonic vibe to this thing that's already percolating underneath, and just kind of, and just stitch it together and then hope we sell them, you know, hope we can sell 1,000, that we're not looking at them in our basements for the rest of our lives.
Was Uncle Tupelo based out of Chicago? Were they here? Were they around? Were they around that world?
From Festus, Missouri, which is right outside of St. Louis.
And Jeff married the owner of Lounge Axe, which was the seminal punk club here. And they were here enough stepchildren, I guess.
Right, right. what was your first release? Like, what was the first thing you guys put out as Bloodshot Records?
It was that compilation of Chicago bands. It's called For a Life of Sin, Insurgent Chicago Country.
Is that still in print?
Yep.
Yeah, are all your records still in print?
Well, in the digital sense, yes. in the physical sense. I wish they all were. 75 to 80% of them are. Sometimes it just doesn't make financial sense for a label our size to keep something in print just so we can sell two.
What was the moment for you guys when you had put out a few records and thought, like, oh wait, yeah, we can actually do this, like,
I'll let you know when we get there.
Well, I'd like to think that the new compilation, that's going to be that record.
Yes. I remember in maybe a CMJ party in the afternoon on the Lower East Side, they wouldn't let our bands into the festival itself, so through connections in New York, we hired a bar for the afternoon, and we had Moonshine Willie and the world famous Blue Jays, the Waco Brothers and the Old 97s, and we were hoping for some bodies to show up. And at one point in the afternoon, I went outside because it was so crowded in there, and I looked, and there was a line down the block, and Greil Marcus was in the line, and so was Robert Christgau, these two famous rock writers, mm-hmm. and who I had met a couple times before, and they were like, hey, can you get me into this? And I remember standing there on the street, and it was about 6 o'clock in the fall, and it was kind of getting a little dusky out, and I was like, oh my God, we got to take this seriously.
Yeah, something's happening.
and then when Alejandro Escovedo on stage at South by Southwest was introduced as a Bloodshot artist, and the whole room just erupted, that's when I remember turning to who I was with and just like, oh my God, this is real. Because when someone of the caliber of Alejandro Escovedo is entrusting you with his art, you know,
I mean, that must have been,
it's time to stop fucking around.
That must have been an amazing thing when you guys had been established long enough that artists that you listened to and loved started coming to you to put their records out. I assume that
was huge.
Must have happened at some point.
It's the big payback. I mean, there's plenty of easier ways to make a living, but being able to work with these artists you love and respect, and being able to, you know, pay your bills that way.
And to be working with people who you have tattered old LPs of that you played 1,000 times, and now you can just kind of, when they come by the office, just kind of, you know, when the staff isn't looking, you know, just kind of like, hey, could you sign this for me?
Right. And the opposite end of that, what's it like when you guys have found a band and kind of nurtured them and put out their records, and then they leave the nest and go on to another label, another, like maybe get signed to a major? How's that?
It's always bittersweet, but the ultimate goal of what we do is to we believe in these artists in the first place. So if they want to make that decision to go to that next, to attempt life at that next level and all that is entailed in that, we can't get in the way of that. I don't begrudge anyone for doing that. You want to get there? We can't buy people tour buses or fly them to London to meet a writer or vice versa. It's fine. You know, we made a conscious decision many years ago, either by, I think, largely based on our temperament of not wanting to work with too many other people or work for other people, that even when Ryan Adams' record exploded on us, that we wanted to keep things a manageable level and not get caught up in the boom and bust mentality.
Was that the first record that really sold a lot of copies for you?
Yeah, went into a level that we had no experience in.
Yeah. Right. Did you guys put out Whiskey Town Records before that? Did you have a relationship with him before that?
We had a relationship, and we put out a double 7-inch before it.
And he had done some compilation tracks, right. He had been on Alejandro's record. So he was a fan of ours from early on.
And we were friends. I mean, Whiskey Town would, you know, sleep on my floor when they came through town and stuff.
And when they slept. And back to your point, though, and there have been a lot of people that have gone on to major labels or have been on major labels and realized that, why am I selling 200,000 records and not making any money? I'm going to go back to these guys where I'll sell 20, 25, 40 and make a living.
Back, right.
Yeah. And
you've had people leave to go to a major label and actually come back.
Leave and come back.
Really? And people who are on other, who are never on our label, who heard from, however they heard about us or whatever, that, hey, we don't want to do this sausage grinder anymore.
Right. How is the business side of running a label? I mean, I know it's in the
last
20
easy.
Years.
Oh, it's easy. That's the fun part. That's really, really why, staring at Excel spreadsheets all day, that's why I got into this.
Exactly. It's fun. I could see when I got here that your eyes were like burned out and glowing from staring at computer screen. Well, I was going to ask, how's it changed for you guys over the years? And how's it changed for your artists? I mean, I remember when I was like, a young guy starting out, and I was in a band that was on Fat Records, and we would put out records, and the label would give us records to sell on tour, and we kind of existed really through selling T-shirts. But looking back, I loved it so much that it didn't ever seem hard. It just seemed like, I can't fucking believe I'm paying my rent through this shit. But it seems to me that it's much harder now to pull that off.
Yes.
I mean, you know, obviously nobody sells records anymore.
Sell records right. Today. I mean, we have to work harder and smarter to sell a third as many records as we did 10 years ago. And it's because, you know, a whole generation of people have grown up getting their music for free. And it's part of the bigger cultural problem where, you know, people have gotten used to creative content being free or thinking it could be or should be. And so, I mean, all we can do is educate the fans that we connect with to let them know that if they buy that CD or that LP or T-shirt from the band at a show, that's putting money in that band's gas tank so that they can come back there.
And, you know, when we first started, it was a pretty top-to-bottom model. It was a pretty monolithic system. You know, you had the few big labels dictating what every store would do and how they would get it. All we would manufacture our CDs, send them all to the distributor, and then they would take care of how they got dribbled out there. It was very top-down, very old-school kind of moving the widgets process, and the internet just obliterated that, both for good and for ill, as Nan was talking about. The good part is that now anyone could find our stuff anywhere and buy it from anywhere, that all of a sudden the guy in Fargo could mail order from us or go on our website and buy it, and he wasn't beholden to, did the guy at the, you know, Best Buy 50 miles from his house stock it? And he would never hear about it. So dissemination of the music has been the great plus of all this. But then there's the obvious downsides of
it. Yeah, I mean, it's dramatic.
But so with the business side of that, that meant, again, that we would just ship things all to one place and keep track of them, but now it's you know, a swirling vortex of people you got to keep track of store. We're going individually to stores and talking to them individually and going to all these little micro sites and finding any little contact that you can. And so it's this protocol we call multiple income dribbles that hopefully at the end of the year equals we get to do this for another year.
Right. Like, as all the big chain stores for, chain record stores have gone away, has the same thing happened to the mom and pops, or have they flourished because of that?
Oh, there's an absolute resurgence in those kinds of stores.
Really?
They may not be carrying, they're decidedly not carrying as many titles, but they are, like labels like us, they're more a product of the individual personality of the owners. So right. They're more kind of maybe specialty or more focused or curated, and they're selling coffee, they're selling books, they're selling all sorts of other things. So they're not the standalone record store of our youth, but they're popping back up, and they're finding ways, creative ways to stay in business, and they're flying under the radar of the industry. And that's why, you know, those guys are in there on the phone all day long or on their keyboards.
Making sure they've got
making
your records,
sure,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how the bands that you sign have had to adapt to all those changes. How do you guys like sort of teach your baby bands how to get out there and tour and sustain momentum or a career?
Yeah, Jesus Christ, if we could teach them anything.
And do they listen?
No. The hardest part for me personally, I can talk to the band part if Nan wants to. But the hardest part for me personally is when we started out, we could do one-off projects, side projects, thematic projects that there would be no tour behind it. There's maybe not even a real band behind it. It was just maybe a creature of the studio. And we could sell a few thousand of those, enough to break even and have this. And so those are some of my favorite records in our catalog. And it would be okay. We could go on and fight another day because it didn't hurt anyone. Now we can't do those because unless you're out on the road half the year promoting it, selling it off the bandstand, always doing something to fill the insatiable maw of the internet, we just can't do it. It's not economically feasible. So we have had to pass on a lot of projects that I would have loved to have done, and a lot of other projects don't even begin because of that new reality. And that, I think, makes us poorer culturally because there's all this art that's not even, you know, getting to the point of not being promoted. It's just not getting created because no one can see a way to make it pay off.
Well, that's sort of like the thing that doesn't get discussed much when people talk about the way that the internet and technology has changed the music industry. And when you look at it and you look at all the great old studios that have closed down, all that stuff, there's the whole side of it that you can't, when you take away all the resources to create art, then art suffers, you know? And I feel like that's often lost in the discussion about like digital technology and, you know, Spotify or whatever, you know, how it's just sort of
changed all the time. And it's the great democratization of the internet, and that there was certainly a lot to be said for the smashing of that monolithic state that we had before. But what's the end? What's the like absurd logical conclusion to all this? Is that everyone will make one record and sell it to one person, or everyone will write one novel and sell it to one person? There's no filter anymore. And in some ways that's good, but if people are not rewarded for their creative output, they're not going to be able to, unless we go back to a nice medieval patronage system.
That would work well. Well, I think we're getting pretty close, actually, with the way that's a bigger discussion. I look at my own.
It's changed bands. the way bands have changed is that you can no longer be a band that's going to be like, oh, yeah, we'll tour like 5 days a month. You know, we'll do long weekend tours. We had bands that would do the Milwaukee, Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis, you know, 3-4 times a year and break even. And now they can't do that. You have to commit as a band to being out there a lot more. You can't at the end of the show disappear.
Right.
you got to be out there helping to sell merch. You got to be taking pictures. You got to be doing podcasts. You got to be doing all the little things all the time.
I'm glad you threw podcast in there. Thank you.
You can't. And this is, you know, coming from where I came from, the scene I came in from, you can't have like a totally demented, drunken maniac show where everything just goes off the rails because it's up on YouTube the next day and everyone's like, oh, fuck those guys, they're unprofessional. And
right.
It's like fans want this razor-thin tension between extreme professionalism and still that like freedom of rock and roll.
Right.
And it's just unsustainable. I think it's got to tear itself apart. And if it goes either way, then the next morning there is 100 people ready to slam you for it.
Absolutely.
You can't have a bad show in private, you know?
Right. Right. You know, I've always, through the years, like since I've been in the Foo Fighters, I've always done smaller side projects and stuff outside of Foo's. And the numbers just don't make sense anymore. I mean, I when I think about what a young band has to go through to get out on the road, when you look at what it costs to rent a van or buy a van, you know, let's say you're renting a van and you're getting maybe 2 hotel rooms a night and everybody just kind of crashes in there and gas, and then you're getting paid $50 or $100 a night, the numbers just don't add up. Like, I honestly look at that and I go, how the fuck does anybody do it anymore? I don't get it.
Wow, you must have been in some fancy young bands where you actually even got hotel rooms.
Seriously, yeah, that's living high on the hog.
We were just putting it out there like, hey, can we stay at your house at the end of the show? You know?
I mean, I look at, like, when I go out with, like, Dead Peasants, and this is the reason I put out a Dead Peasants record a year or two ago, and I made a decision at the time, we're just not going to tour because I can't wind up spending tens of thousands of dollars to do that. It doesn't make sense. It makes me not enjoy it, you know, in the long run. That's not what it's supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about having a good time. Because when we've toured in the past and when I've toured with other things, I just lose so much money that it's not possible, you know? So I don't see, like, what do young bands do to get out there? I guess it's commitment, but it's an impossible commitment.
The only bands that can get out there anymore are those bands that are so motivated that they can't help themselves, that this is all they want to do out of life, and there's no such thing as being, you know, a casual musician and having that be public anymore. If you're going to be a casual musician, you're you know, playing at home, and you know, you have your day job and you practice at home and play in your basement and maybe play some open mics, but other than that, you know, there's now this gulf between those bands who are going at it, you know, as their only objective. And that's what they have to do. And these young bands have to do that. They have to be out there, you know, 150 plus days a year. And so that also means that someone has to book all those dates. And how do you get that booking agent, especially the first one? And it's that much harder today than ever for a band trying to get a record out. And you can't just do it for fun. It has to be your living.
And if you're out there 150 days a year, where does that give you the time to sit quietly in a room and write a song or to develop a song?
Sure.
You know, especially if you're starting out, you're the first band of 3. Sound men and other bands are not known for being, you know, super patient on letting this new band, you know, work out the earth.
Take all the time you need.
Work on that bridge. Yeah, keep that's right. Fine. That's fine.
Yeah, that's funny. Like, what do you guys see as the you know, secret to your guys' longevity? I mean, this is a long time for a label to have been around in this day and age.
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, certainly luck and timing plays into it. And Rob mentioned that we never went for the whole boom and bust mentality and chose to stay, you know, small and nimble and be able to, you know, jump on opportunities when they come up. But, you know, part of that is also being frugal and sticking to what we love to do and working with bands we love so that we don't, we aren't doing it to make money. We just have to make enough to support, you know, to pay the payroll and, you know, and to hopefully make enough money so that the bands can live off of it too.
We also make a great deal of money trafficking in panda cubs. That's in the basement. We didn't show you that part of the tour.
Oh, yeah, you left that part out this morning. Can I get a panda cub before I leave?
Wait,
I'll pay top dollar.
Okay,
I'll give you my whole touring fund, man.
We'll give you one of the ones with the limp.
Nice. Yeah, those are my faves.
Everything we do, everything that has anything to do with our longevity or our success, to whatever degree we've had, that is predicated on our continuing love and curiosity of music. When that goes away, then the label goes away, right? I guess. As long as that's there, we'll continue to work hard and figure out how to make the enterprise carry forward.
What do you think is the best record you guys have put out that nobody knows about? What's your favorite record
that
nobody knows about? And why don't people know about it?
Oh, man.
There's a few.
Dang, I like that, because I'm so tired of answering that. What are your three favorite records? And it's
right.
I'm not going to answer that, because it changes every month.
Sure.
And wow. I can answer that in two ways. To me, the Roger Knox and the Pine Valley Cosmonauts record we put out a couple of years ago, Stranger in My Country, Roger Knox is an Aboriginal country and Western singer.
Mm.
American country and Western music got over to Australia in World War II and through servicemen. The Aboriginals heard it and thought, this is an amazing protest form of music. And in a way, this culture was so subjugated in ways that up until so recently, it was just mind-boggling to know this story. And John Langford and I went over there, and he'd been working with this guy for years, and we went over there and recorded all these folk songs, protest songs that were done to honky-tonk.
Mm.
Deeply, deeply important, moving, heartbreaking, hilarious, resilient, powerful stuff.
Mm.
And some people heard it. It didn't find the audience. I hope he's unable to tour. He's, you know, 60. It's hard for him to get around. Australia's a big country. They have kind of turned their back on this whole ugly chapter in their history and don't really want to be reminded about it.
Sure.
It's amazing stuff. Lyrically, sonically, beautiful. The other way I'd answer this is I couldn't name one album, but I could name two artists, Trailer Bride and Devil in a Woodpile, who I go back to their records all the time. And they were bands that were weekenders. But I love them. They are just, you know, people should seek that stuff out. One is super weird, swampy, southern, sly guitar, very gun, kind of like a female-fronted gun club. And the other one is just kind of a Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Chicago back porch blues. And
right.
Eminently entertaining stuff that people didn't hear because they didn't tour.
How involved do you guys get in like the overseeing, you know, it's kind of A&R-ing or producing the records that you guys put out? Are you like in the studio with your bands, or are you completely hands off?
We offer to be as involved or as uninvolved as the bands want. And early on, we were pretty involved. A lot of the bands were young, and we were young and thought it was more important to be in the studio. And so really, it runs the gamut of what that individual band needs and wants.
Yeah, typically, early on, I was involved in a lot of the production and a lot of the mixing. And now, mostly, if I am involved, it's with the mastering end of it and the sequencing. But now it's, you know, that's one thing that's changed for me personally over the years with the business side of it is there's just so much more business side of it to do. I can't go to whatever town and spend 10 days there and do stuff like that anymore. I gotta be here to do this. And also, I think we've grown up in such a way that we believe in the artist and we trust what they're gonna do, and we'll maybe know the producer or the studio and just be like, okay, you guys make, this is your record. This is how You know, you don't need me standing over your shoulder. I'll offer advice if you call me and want it, but it's the way you want to present yourself to the world. So that's up to you.
Have you ever had an artist on your label that you've put out, you know, a few records with, and then they went into the studio and made something that you're like, yeah, we can't put this out? Have you ever had to have that conversation?
Yeah, there's been some uncomfortable moments like that, of course.
We're not putting out your disco jazz record. It's just not what we do.
Well, it's never been quite that extreme where we've said, no, we're not putting this out. You know, but there's certainly been bands who have gone in directions that aren't, you know, where our hearts are at so much, but often those have more commercial potential. Mm. And it's where that band wants to be.
And if someone wants to go somewhere else and do something completely different, more often than not, they're completely free to do that. I mean, we don't want people here who don't want to be here. And
right.
The way the Chicago scene is set up and how we developed our business model with Thrill Jockey and Drag City and Touch and Go and all these very artist-friendly labels is, you know, a lot of times there's no contracts. There's just, oh, you want to do this project with us? Great. You want to do the next one with them because it fits them more? Great. I mean, which fosters an incredible creativity in the city,
right? And trust, probably.
Yeah, which we take for granted here. But I know if you go to other towns, and you know, labels are always, you know, in competition with each other, or you know, you're with him or you're with us kind
right.
of mentality. And
is there like a real sense of community between the indie labels that you guys are associated with?
I think more so between the artists, and then from the indie labels, we know each other and we're friendly and we do reach out to each other. But we don't have time to, you know, meet regularly and network. And so it's more that we all, I think, just generally can't come from the place where we all feel that the better each of us does, the better we'll all do.
Right. And we all know each other well enough to know that we're in this because we're all music fans.
Right.
And the community is tight enough that if somebody fucks somebody over, word about that would get over.
Right.
Would get out pretty
oh, yeah.
quickly. So
sure.
I mean, there's that checks and balances system in
right.
there too.
Keeps itself together. I have one more question with you, and this is, you know, I can say this from personal experience. You know, dealing with musicians is like a gigantic pain in the ass. what keeps you guys
really?
Getting up every morning to do this, you know, over and over again? What keeps you coming back?
I mean, for me, it's, you know, at that show, that the last time the band played in town, there were 40 people, and then they come back, and we've done a good job publicizing it and sharing, you know, their story and their music, and there's 100 people there, and that feels good. But then also at that show, there's that moment of brilliance. There's that that great harmony or that great lead or something new and exciting that just puts a dumb smile on my face, where I'm still excited about the music and I'm just amazed by what that artist is able to do now, or even though they've been doing it for a few records. And so it's that sort of thing that keeps me going. And also when, you know, we may not be involved in the recording and then an artist turns in a record and I'm hearing a done record and for the first time and it bowls me over. And that's what this is all about. That's what keeps me going for sure.
Yeah, it's ever since I've been a cognizant form of human being, you know, I believe then and I believe now in the transformative power of music, and to be involved and to be entrusted with the output of some pretty amazing people, that's what keeps me going. Early on, a lot of these artists were living at my house and they're coming through town, staying for weeks at a time, woodshedding the new record, something like this. I've been very involved in their personal lives. And that was a great way to be driven to madness. And now that I have a little more, you know, experience and age and a little more distance and perspective, it's like I can just focus on the music. And when somebody comes up with this great thing and we're involved in it and we're entrusted with it, it's just, it's great to be part of this amazing continuum of independent labels in this city. And then when you, you know, I don't work in a coal mine. I don't work in a cube farm out on I-290. I get to go see these shows. And every once in a while, I mean, we've got, you know, garbage cans full of demos. But every once in a while, you hear something. They're like, oh, okay, I got to put this down on my notebook and maybe go see them when they're in town. And you go see this band in town and there's two people there and you're one of them. And you just see this spark of something that reminds you of the first time you heard Howlin' Wolf or something. Mm. That it's like that makes you really excited. And with this 20-year thing, hearing all these people that I had never heard of taking songs that I'd been a part of and disassembling them and putting them back together in this amazing new way and saying that we had something to do with where they are is just perpetually humbling.
And is the record out yet? Is it in stores now?
No.
When's it coming out?
November
18th.
November 18th. Okay, go ahead.
But you can pre-order now.
Yes. Cool. Well, thank you, guys. Thanks for spending some time with me today.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Great. All right. That was Rob and Nan from Bloodshot Records. How cool are they? Make sure you go to bloodshotrecords.com to check out whatever is happening in their world. And you can order that 20-year anniversary record. It's great. It's got loads of really good artists covering other really good artists. It's awesome. And we're proud to have been a part of it. Make sure you tune back in next week for my interview with legendary surf filmmaker Jack McCoy. The man, the myth, the legend, Jack McCoy. I caught up with him recently when we were down in Australia and had a really good long talk, and I'm going to post that in 2 weeks. So check that out. And if there's any other Walking the Floor episodes that you missed and you want to go listen to them, like the Dwight Yoakam, like Brad Paisley, like Steve Earle, there's a lot of them up there, go to walkingthefloor.com where you can stream any of the interviews we've done, or you can always go to your iTunes and download it out of the Apple Store podcast thingy. I don't even know how that works, but, you know, I'm a Luddite, so get it on. And I will see you in 2 weeks. Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos. Let's go.
In the empty bottle, it misses you. Yet I'm the one that it's talking to. And with you and I, just barely strangers, pretty much just left.